Lecture 36, The Judicial Machinery of the Legal System.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. In this lecture, I'm going to discuss what we may call the judicial machinery of the legal system. We examine the three important components of this machinery: the magistrates, that is the archons and other elected officials, the courts, and the private and public arbitrators. In doing so, we can see again the importance that the Athenians attached to law and their readiness to participate in the legal system, perhaps more so than their zeal to take part in the political life of the city. The magistrates we've already met. In the Bronze Age period, justice was dispensed by the kings and perhaps also the tribal elders. By the Archaic period, in the case of Athens, for example, the Areopagus had control of political and judicial life. Day-to-day administration was in the hands of annually elected archons, who had a number of functions, presumably the same ones that the kings used to have. These magistrates would hear disputes themselves and decide the outcomes. But their arbitrary dispensation of justice was countered somewhat once Solon introduced the Heliaea, the Court of Appeal. Although the courts dispensed justice, no case came to court until the appropriate magistrate said so. In other words, the magistrates also had a role in the judicial process because they acted as a middle stage or clearinghouse in indictments. If someone had a dispute or wanted to lay a charge against another person, he would first approach the relevant magistrate to put forward his case. Now, we'll discuss the various types of suits in the next lecture. The magistrate would then decide whether the case had legal grounds or not, and if it did, he would then assign it to a court. If he thought the charge was dubious in any way, or if the matter was settled to the satisfaction of both parties, then the courts were not involved. Sometimes the plaintiff might want to bypass the court system and use an arbitrator, and we'll come on to arbitration shortly. Now, each of the archons had various political duties, as we know, but here in this lecture we're concerned only with their judicial duties. The archons were responsible for different suits, as the Athenian constitution tells us, and these suits included private and public offences. So the Basileus Archon, as we might expect, dealt with cases involving religion, which were mostly public ones. These included impiety, for example, if somebody had been attacked at a religious festival. And they also included disputes over the allocation of priesthoods. These sorts of disturbances at festivals were taken seriously because of the offence that the gods would take, because violence was not supposed to happen at a festival. The Basileus Archon also had jurisdiction over any dispute involving a priest and over homicide suits that were brought by an individual against an alleged murderer, or, for that matter, by a victim's family against the alleged murderer. The eponymous archon dealt with all family and property matters, such as inheritance, guardianship matters involving orphans and heiresses, any maltreatment of orphans and heiresses, insanity cases that involve squandering property, whether someone had abused his parents, or not buried parents in accordance with the laws. The Polymarchos Archon dealt with only private suits, not public ones. What came before the Polymarchos Archon involved metics, that is, the resident aliens of Athens. And the Athenian constitution says that the Polymarchos Archon did for metics what the eponymous Archon did for citizens. These cases could range from a metic committing a crime to inheritance matters involving a metic's estate. When a foreigner became an Athenian citizen, he was supposed to have a sponsor who had to be a full citizen. Any foreigner who didn't have a sponsor or who abused his sponsor in some way was also under the jurisdiction of the polymarchus. Incidentally, having a sponsor is like the equivalent today of sponsoring a family member to move to join someone living in a foreign country. Presumably, as litigation increased and the archons had to deal with more claims, they found that they just couldn't cope with them. There were only so many hours in the day after all. Hence, they delegated some judicial tasks to the six thesmothetae. Now, these thesmothetae may have begun as something akin to secretaries, as we talked about. But by the 4th century, they had judicial powers that included assigning the days on which the courts met and introducing various public and private cases to court. These included public ones, such as non-citizens masquerading as citizens, graphe paranomone, bribery, and failure to register as a debtor. Now, those in debt to the state were denied various political and judicial rights until they discharged their debts. If they died before they could do so, the debt passed on to their children. Private suits included mining and commercial ones, where a slave had abused a freeman, and also perjury before the Areopagus. The thesmothetae also introduced the euthynae, or the reckoning, of the elected officials. The euthynae was a scrutiny of a magistrate's year in office, and if he were found to have been corrupt or not discharged his duties properly, he was not allowed to enter the Areopagus, and he might even face criminal charges in a court of law. Now, we don't know what form the euthynae took, but it was a balance to the dokimassia, and the dokimassia is the inquiry into those putting themselves forward as candidates for election to the political office. Now, passages from a speech by the late 4th century orator Dinarchus give us some idea of the questions asked at the dokimassia, and these were both technical and moral. They included whether the candidate had legitimate children, whether he treated his parents well, whether he owned land in accordance with the laws, whether he'd served in the army on campaign, even whether he'd paid his taxes. Now, most of these stipulations strike us as reasonable, and we often hear the same things being trotted out today by candidates for political office. But the one about owning land appears a little odd. However, it refers to someone who owns land or a house, which is obviously on a plot of land, that he acquired legally. Presumably, if our candidate were found to have neglected some of these during his term in office, he might still fail his euthynae. The Athenian legal system also had in it magistrates who had specific technical or professional duties, given the job they did, and these made them responsible for cases in their own particular areas. These are akin to public prosecutors, if you like, and they include officials who were in charge of the trade and the marketplace. These were called agoranomoi, from agora meaning the market. Then there were officials who were in charge of the corn supply, the sitophulakes. And these men were also responsible for allegations of bad business practice. For example, the sitophulakes were especially important given the reliance of Athens on imported corn from the Black Sea area. Then there were the 10 strategoi, the generals. They dealt with cases that involved military crimes, as we might expect. Crimes such as throwing away your shield in battle, in other words, desertion, cowardice, or trying to get out of military duty. Now, all of these actions were indictable, And if found guilty, the person accused of one lost his citizenship. There were also the 10 synagoroi, or public advocates. They prosecuted a magistrate who had failed his euthynē. And they also prosecuted other public prosecutors who prosecuted those found guilty after an investigation by the assembly or the boule. For example, under an eisangelia, a procedure I'll discuss in my next lecture. I've mentioned before the 11, who were a type of police force that was also in charge of the prison. We don't know what the prerequisite was for being a member of the 11, but I'd imagine that a powerful build was one thing that was needed, as no doubt people tried to resist arrest. Since Athens was one of the larger polis in the classical period, it had literally hundreds of magistrates and officials to administer it. It also had a large number of courts, and that brings me to discuss courts now in our lecture. We've already said a lot about the courts in our survey of the development of the legal code, but they were another part of the judicial machinery, and we need to make some comments on them here and now. For the archaic and early classical periods, the Areopagus was responsible with the archons for dispensing justice. But it was Ephialtes' legislation in 462 that rendered the Areopagus largely impotent, apart from certain judicial functions that we mentioned last time. These judicial functions were the right to judge cases of premeditated homicide, of wounding, arson, damage to the sacred olive trees, and attempted tyranny or subversion of the constitution. Everything else, including the right to judge an official's conduct during his office, fell to the courts, the assembly, and the boule. The religious nature of homicide made it an especially heinous crime because it affected the gods. And until a homicide matter was resolved, the city was in a state of miasma or pollution. The city was polluted. It was necessary to lift this miasma as quickly and expeditiously as possible without causing further pollution. And so the type of homicide spawned a number of different courts. That's why there were 5 special courts set up to try the different types of homicide. And in all of these courts, apart from the Areopagus, the jurors numbered 51. I'd like to say a few words about each of these 5 courts now and the different types of homicides that came before them. To begin with, there was the Areopagus, something of an old friend by now. As we said, the Areopagus tried cases of premeditated homicide, and all of its members would judge these cases. The second court was that of the Palladion, which tried cases of unintentional homicide, of planning a homicide, and of killing a metic, foreigner, or a slave. Then there was the court of the Delphinion, which tried cases of justified homicide. In Athenian law, justified homicide involves someone who killed another in self-defense, or who killed a competitor at the Olympic Games. For example, in the Pancration contest, where apparently the only rules were don't kill your opponent and don't gouge his eyes out. Also under the justified homicide law was killing an adulterer. But a husband who caught his wife having sex with another man could kill that adulterer, but there was not to be any premeditation. He had to catch the adulterer in the act. Justified homicide also covered anyone who killed a person trying to subvert the constitution. Our fourth court was the Prytaneion, which judged cases where the murderer was unidentified. When a suit was brought to the Prytaneion, the murderer, shall we say, the unidentified murderer, was simply referred to as the doer of the deed. The Prytaneion also judged cases where an animal or an object had caused a death, For example, if a rock fell down on someone and killed him, or if a horse bolted and ran someone over, killing that person. Now, today, a case like this would probably be handled as a coroner's inquiry. But back then, because someone had still been killed in a violent manner, and hence the gods were involved, that case still had to be judged. Our fifth and final court was in the sanctuary of Phraates. Now, this dealt with someone who was currently living in exile because he'd been found guilty of homicide before. But while living in exile, he'd killed again. Perhaps he killed an Athenian who was living abroad, or he killed an Athenian trader who is then operating in some other polis or state and therefore not living in Athens. And so the murderer was now accused of another killing. Now, this person could defend himself against the new homicide charge, but he had to make his defense not in the actual sanctuary, but on a boat, which was anchored off the coast at Phraates. Now, the defendant put forward his case from this boat so that he didn't need to set foot on Attic soil. Because, you see, being found guilty of homicide before, if he did actually step foot on Attic soil, he would be polluting the land. Now, once trial by jury became the norm, all of the law courts became an important part of the Athenian constitution. They met regularly for over two-thirds of the year, and each year a panel of 6,000 citizens was elected to the jury board and swore an oath to uphold the laws, as we've talked about before. What's interesting about the courts is that their location, supposedly in the Agora of Athens, is still unknown. Now, there doesn't seem to have been a fixed building made of stone, which was the law court. Like today, for example, where we can actually point to the building and say, there's the Supreme Court, or there's the Municipal Court, or something like that. And very often in Athens, cases were heard in other buildings, like the Odeum, built close to the Acropolis in the age of Pericles. Now, these other buildings would be used for a variety of functions, just like today we have sports stadiums, which can be used for sporting fixtures, as well as converted to house the big arena rock bands. Well, it was like that back in classical Athens. There's also a belief that the courts might have been portable structures, in the sense that they could easily be erected and dismantled depending on the case. Now, for some cases, as we know, we get very large juries. They can number in the four figures. And the lowest number is 201. So clearly, if you have a building with a fixed number of seats, then that building can only accommodate that number. But if you're able to put together a number of movable seats, like bleachers today, for example, and put these together in one area or forming one hall, because remember, these are open roof structures, so you don't have to worry about ceilings or roofs, then that would solve the problem when you have a jury of a large number. Now, as we've talked about before, the jurors took their role seriously in the constitution, even though the pay was measly. It had been increased by Cleon in 424 to 3 obols a day, that's half a drachma, whereas an unskilled labourer at that time made 1 drachma a day, made twice as much. Moreover, jury pay remained at this rate, 3 obols a day, even by the late 4th century, so 100 years after Cleon raised it. However, by then, that's by the late 4th century, assembly pay was 3 times greater at 1.5 drachmas per day. Now, this different rate of pay has implications, I believe, for how the Athenians viewed their participation in civic life. And by extension, I think, what they wanted to do in the state. Does higher assembly pay indicate that the assembly was a more important organ of the constitution? It did debate and decide all domestic and foreign policy. And so as a result, the people deserved a higher rate of pay for attending it. Well, that might make perfect sense. On the other hand, Perhaps the higher rate was to induce Athenians to attend the assembly, perhaps because there wasn't always a quorum. And since there was always a queue of men at the law courts wanting to be selected as jurors that day, then there was no need to raise jury pay because there was never any shortage of men wanting to do that job. Now, we know that in the 5th century, a man carrying a rope dipped in vermilion dye would go into the agora, the market area. He would twirl his rope around, and whoever got hit by it would get a red mark on him. Those men who got those red marks would then have to go up to the Pnyx to attend the assembly. Now, that indicates that the people were less thrilled at attending an assembly than being jurors. And as a result, they had to be coaxed to the assembly with greater pay. The final part of the judicial machinery that I want to discuss is the arbitrators. Now, these people are extremely important in the Constitution. We've already talked about the role of arbitrators in early Greek law, when two parties that couldn't reconcile their differences approached either a king or a tribal elder, in other words, a third party, to settle the dispute. This was handled fairly informally. Arbitration was a much used part of the judicial machinery and process in the classical period, and it was probably used as a means to reduce the workload of the courts. In other words, to stop them getting bogged down with all manner of cases, particularly in the 4th century when litigation increased so dramatically. By the classical period, arbitration was a formal process and it was governed by law. There were both private and public arbitrators, the public ones being appointed by the state. Now, public arbitration was seen as a civic duty. And all males in their 60th year, in other words, at age 59, were required by law to serve as arbitrators. Therefore, just as it was expected that ordinary citizen males would attend the assembly or be a juror, so the same citizens were expected to serve as public arbitrators when they became old enough. In actual fact, expected is the wrong verb there. An Athenian citizen need not necessarily attend the assembly or be a juror. These would be the passive citizens who didn't take part in political life. But notice, under Athenian law, at age 59, you had to be a public arbitrator. So there's no wriggling out of that, except in special circumstances that we'll talk about in a second. Now, there are significant differences between private and public arbitration. In a private arbitration, both sides had to agree as to who the arbitrator was going to be. Both sides had to state what the dispute was about and that they would accept the arbitrator's verdict. And the arbitrator had to accept and swear that he would arbitrate in a fair and just manner. So this was something akin to the juror's oath. Probably, settling on an arbitrator who is agreeable to both parties was the biggest hurdle. Say you wanted to use one of your friends or a family member who would obviously be biased towards you. This person would clearly be unacceptable to the other party. That's perhaps why we know that the state sometimes appointed arbitrators, presumably impartial men who had no connection with either of the disputants. Now, in a private arbitration, the theory was that both parties accepted the arbitrator's verdict because both had agreed in advance on who the person was going to be. However, if after a public arbitration, one of the disputants didn't accept the verdict, then he had the right to appeal it. And if he chose to do so, he had recourse to several avenues. First, he could accuse the arbitrator of bias towards him. This would involve summoning a meeting of all of the arbitrators appointed for that year and bringing a charge of eisangelia against the arbitrator in question. Now, eisangelia is a procedure that's normally translated as impeachment. Now, if the board of arbitrators decided that the arbitrator in question was corrupt, then the penalty was atimia, in other words, the loss of citizenship rights. When this happened, the accused arbitrator did have the right of appeal himself, but obviously, since he could suffer the loss of citizenship rights, it was very much in his favour to avoid bias. A second alternative was for someone who felt aggrieved to apply for the case to go to a formal law court. Now, when that happened, the evidence from the arbitration was sealed until the trial. It was sealed in two urns, one for the prosecution and one for the defence. What's more, only the evidence from the arbitration could be used in the trial. Nothing extra could be introduced after the original arbitration. Now, the arbitration itself took place in a public place where anyone could go along and listen. Both sides put forward their cases, and the arbitrator tried to get both parties to agree to a compromise while the hearing took place. If he couldn't do this for some reason, then he fixed a day when he would make his decision, and on that day he gave his verdict. Now, some arbitrators were what were called tribal judges. Four were elected from each of the 10 tribes that had been created by Cleisthenes in 508. These tribal judges decided private cases brought by members of their tribe. If the amount involved was less than 10 drachmas, the tribal judge settled the matter himself. If the amount was more than 10 drachmas, then a public arbitrator was brought in. This public arbitrator would make his decision, he would report it to the tribal judges, and then in the process, he'd take his one drachma payment. Notice that's twice as much as the payment for a juryman. Arbitration was seen as a convenient way of settling a dispute out of court, especially for those who might feel intimidated facing a large jury and having to argue a case before it. And this is an important point. There were no professional lawyers in classical Athens, and individuals had to prepare their cases as well as appear on behalf of themselves in court. Juries were also large, usually of several hundred citizens, and not everyone had the self-confidence or especially the legal know-how to appear before this large audience. It seems that the vast majority of private disputes never made it to a court of law. Hence, arbitration was meant to reduce the workload of the courts, to stop them getting bogged down with all sorts of cases from the most trivial to the most extreme. Also, as I've said, public arbitration was a civic duty. And that's why all citizens in their 60th year had to serve as public arbitrators. And they could only get out of serving for that year if they happened to be holding another office at the time, or if they were out of the city on business. Apart from the age requirement, the similarity with our jury service, and especially the reasons for trying to wriggle out of it, are rather obvious, aren't they? In the next lecture, Judicial Process, I want to discuss some of the public and private cases and procedures of the legal system. And I also want to talk about the preliminaries to the trial, including witness testimony. I'll also discuss the sycophants or blackmailers, who, oddly to us, were part of the judicial process as well. We've been seeing so far that the role of the people when it comes to prosecuting or defending is far more hands-on than it is today, because classical Athens didn't have any equivalent of the modern attorney. Well, that's true. But in the next lecture, I want to argue that there's enough in the classical system to see the origins of the modern lawyer as well. Thank you very much.